When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Stories with Briscoe and Bradshaw. I am Bradshaw. That would be Mr. Briscoe, the Oklahoma legend. And when looks are important in wrestling, there was nobody in the history of the business who had a better look than the total package. A record for the U.S. Championship as far as length held, consecutive days held, two-time WCW champion, world heavyweight champion, four horsemen. He has done it all, and he is our guest, and we're proud that he is. Mr. Lex Luger, thanks for joining our show.
Wow, what a lead-in. Thank you, John. I'm honored to be on. I love Lex, watching your show, and I'm looking forward to hanging out with you guys for a little bit here.
Lex, we just want to have some laughs with you, but, you know, I'm honored. I'm honored to be here because I'm honored to be with two of the longest reigning champions in my business, you know, Lex Luger and John Layfield. And what a privilege it is. But, you know, just to go back, we tried to do this interview last week, and there was an electrical storm where you're located in Atlanta, yeah. Georgia, and we had trouble with Wi-Fi. But we asked you a question. We wanted to get it rolling because we're so thrilled to have you on here. We didn't want to miss the opportunity. You opened up the segment with lady. You know, I asked you to share a little bit about your beginning career. Everybody knows about your wrestling career, but your early career. I know you played at Penn State. Then you went to Miami, transferred to Miami. You were a high school basketball star, which I want to get into also because a lot of guys. But when you opened it up and say, yeah, I had a home visit from Joe Paterno, Joe Paul. John and I both were, wow, we got a serious guy here, you know. People don't understand the magnitude of getting a visit like that, you know, and it's wow, phenomenal.
Man. Yeah, he showed up at my high school basketball game the night before the national signing day, which is kind of etched in stone back then in February. And man, everybody high school gym, they flipped out. And then wow. He came back to our house, and what a great memory. And I was actually getting ready to sign with the University of Miami the following day, and Joe flipped me. I ended up going to Penn State my freshman year.
Really? That visit was what switched you over to go to Penn State?
Yeah, the night before the signing date, and I signed the next day with Penn State.
Was it the visit that flipped you over?
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? I thought he was recruiting me kind of like Penn State got so many top recruits back then. I thought Miami wanted me more. But when he came like the night before the national signing, I go, he must really like want me to come here. So yeah, that definitely flipped me.
So tell us a little bit about that basketball career. You know, you were a big guy. I mean, you're what, 6'4" in high school, 6'4", 6'5", whatever it was. That's big in high school. I mean, you're a man playing with boys basically at that time.
Well, back in my day, I just loved playing hoops. I went to, back in the day, the Nike Jesus Camps, five-star basketball camp was the big camp in Honesdale, PA, and all the best players nationally. I went to that camp like 3 years in a row. So I was a decent hoopster, but I stopped growing at 6'4", and I was like a power forward, and there aren't too many Charles Barkley's out there. I think he was 6'5", but I realized that football, my physical makeup was probably better suited for football, although I loved playing hoops. I really did.
Did you start playing football at an early age, or did it come along during basketball during high school?
I didn't. I started playing football my freshman year of high school just because my buddies played. I was mainly a basketball player. I almost didn't go out for football my senior year, and my football coach talked me into it. I was at a speaking engagement recently where my high school coaches, football coaches, surprised me. And I told him, you spoke into my life. You said, I remember him telling me, if you put half the effort into football your senior year that you put into basketball, he goes, I guarantee you'll get a full ride almost anywhere you want to go. I go, that changed my life. I ended up playing football, which led me into wrestling. I said, there wouldn't be a Lex Luger that was coming here to listen to speak at this men's group tonight, if it wasn't for you guys, he got off, man, it was a moment. He played football at Syracuse with Jim Brown. He's a rough, tough guy. He got all teared up, man. It was an awesome, awesome moment for us. I've seen him like 40 years.
He talked about Joe Pa and that you didn't even get a picture with him because your parents were not huge college football fans and they really didn't know how big a deal he was.
Oh, man, you did your homework. Yeah, my dad and mom were all about music. I was the only kid in my family that did sports. My dad didn't really understand it. And Joe Pa said, hey, would you like a picture with me on the way out? My dad goes, no, that's okay. Like, I could see Joe's face was like, what the heck? It was probably the first time you ever got turned down for a photo op.
So what was the transition then? What happened at Penn State or what happened at University of Miami that caused you to switch down and go to University of Miami?
The weather.
No kidding.
Two words, yeah. The weather. Happy Valley ain't so happy in the winter. Ooh,
no, it's not.
Through there, walking to class a mile across campus. I ran down the University of Miami to transfer. I would have hitchhiked down there.
You told us before we come on air that you got to play against Ron Simmons in college.
Oh, yeah. What a physical specimen. What a beast. I came out the line of scrimmage. We're playing an afternoon game in the Orange Bowl. It was my first home game in the Orange Bowl. And the guy next to me was playing right across from Ron. And his name was Tom Sedley. He benched about 275 pounds. Ron was standing there with his sleeves rolled up, the veins popping out of his bicep. Tom, his eyes got as big as saucers. He was so scared. Oh, my gosh. Ron Simmons must have like 15 tackles that day. He was an absolute amazing college football game. We said Bobby Bowden with Deion Sanders and all those Hall of Famers out of there. He said Ron Simmons was the greatest college football player he ever coached. Three-time All-American. Wow. Ron was the man. He was something else.
You mentioned him bench pressing 275. Ron set the rookie record when he was with the Cleveland Browns. He did 225 48 times. He broke wild. He was world-class strength.
Oh, freaky. I was in the gym one time in Pittsburgh thinking I was pretty good, you know. I was doing like 405 for like, you know, 8 reps or something. Ron came in and put 225 in the bar. Ron and I talked about this past weekend. I was with Ron. We had a great time at an appearance we did together. And came in, warmed up at 225, went to 315, did a few reps, went to 405 with the four big wheels on each side. Then he went to 5 big wheels each side, which was with the collars on, was 505, and did 4 or 5 reps, got up and walked out of the gym. I was so mad at him. I was like, did you just see that? My gosh. I mean, unbelievable, that guy.
Lex, I traveled with him for years. He would do the same thing years later. And he would show up in his cowboy boots and jeans in the gym, do a little bench press. And, you know, at that time, he'd play with 225, sometimes 315. He didn't go that heavy, you know, as he got older. But he would still played with it like it was full of helium. And he'd be in jeans and boots. And then he'd walk out of the gym. And I'm in there sweating. I'm thinking, I'm working this hard to look this bad. And that man does nothing. It looks like a
star. I always worked out like 2 hours in the gym. Ron comes in and worked out on the bench for like, he looked incredible and walked out about 20 minutes later after repping 505. I'm like, this is insane. Unbelievable.
Wow.
Legendary.
Yeah. Now, Lex, when did the bodybuilding and the weightlifting come into picture for you? At what age?
I actually had the opportunity to work with the world's strongest man. He won the world's strongest man contest in high school outside of Buffalo, New York, where I was born and raised, Don Reinhout. And he was a world-class powerlifter, had the total world record. He squatted like 900-something, benched 600-something. Had the world record deadlift at the time, 885. I mean, he took Craig Wolfley and I and Jim Bird, all three of us ended up playing pro football. We were all on the same high school team. And Craig Wolfley played for Steelers for 13 years. Jim Bird won a Super Bowl with the Giants. And the 49ers, all three of us played high school together, and we worked out with Don Reinhout. He laid that, talk about mentorship now. John and I were talking about earlier. I wanted to get this in while we're talking about this. I told John how he mentored all those young boys through rugby and what he's doing outside of the ring. I know, Jerry, what a difference. You are so beloved by so many of us in the business for your 30 plus years. You and John had all these great in-ring accomplishments, but you guys have meant so much more outside of the ring, and the young people and wrestlers you've mentored and made a difference in, Jerry, and you, John, as well. I just have so much respect for you guys. I really do.
Well, thank you, Lex. Lex, I believe that's, you know, what we're all about in this sport. I mean, we all fought for what we got. We were all athletes, and we worked 24/7 at college athletes, at high school athletes, and even in middle school. And then when we got to pro, that hard work was just something that was ingrained in our soul. And you just want to pass along. You just want to pass a little details along. I mean, anybody can pass a headlock along or a wrist lock or something like that. But if you can pass something along in life like John is doing and like you're doing now, wow, that's a gift that, you know, that we were put here to do. And so thank you for bringing it up.
What an opportunity for us, right?
Yes.
It's really, really, yeah, it's great. But I wanted to let you guys know how much I admire and respect all that you guys have done and are doing. It's special. I appreciate you guys a lot.
I've so enjoyed. I've been inspired by watching your interviews, getting ready for this one, of all the stuff you're doing and the difference you're making in life. It's really an inspirational story. And when you start watching them, you think, I'm not doing enough.
Oh, stop.
Yeah. I mean, very much. It's such a great thing to be able to, because when your name becomes so big, it's good you do something with it that's positive.
Absolutely.
I didn't realize you played with Jim Burt in high school. I know you played with Jim Kelly down at, you know, but you played with Jim Burt at college too, didn't you?
I did. Yeah, he came to Miami. We both went to Miami together.
Yep, he had that famous play where he launched Joe Montana, where he came in there and almost killed him. You know, he was a big, strong man, at Jim Burt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was
a What a high school football team you must have had. Were you guys champions?
We were undefeated our senior year. Wow. And we had a great team. But Don Reinow, getting back to him, he was the biggest human being I'd ever seen. He was 6'4", 365 pounds. He had traps, like they made Goldberg's traps look like minuscule, like two softballs on top of each, off the side of his neck, or Brock Lesnar. I never saw a human being like that in all my life. And we were just awestruck. He took us in to his gym in his basement. He taught us how to, you know, work and how to build a foundation of strength through basic exercises, you know, cleans and deadlifts and bench presses. And that really catapulted us in our football career for sure.
Lex, how did the progression make? I know you had an incident in Georgia with you were mad because you weren't starting, I think it was, and you left the team after in University of Miami. But then you went straight pro. How did that happen? Because that's very unusual. Back then, you had to go 4 years of college. You know, Bosworth kind of got around it initially back in the 80s because he had graduated college and got to leave early. How did it work out for you to end up going to Montreal Alouettes early after only 2 years of college?
This is crazy, but I was actually, if you can believe it, got kicked out of the University of Miami. How do you do that?
This never happened to any athlete.
I mean, how do you do that? I got kicked off the team, and I was bouncing at all the big clubs in Lauderdale at the time. It was the late 70s, and the disco craze was in. I worked at Pete Lenny's. There was a line every night around two blocks to get in that building, and I was the front door guy. And that I used to make, huge tip money, so people didn't have to wait in line. So I'm like, well, I was supposed to play football. Maybe I'm kind of digging this, but there was a scout, a guy at Miami who was a scout in the CFL who talked to Montreal. And once again, a mentor, the guy who worked the front door at Pete Lenny's in Lauderdale, name was Crush. He was a retired pro boxer. His nose was all caved in. His ears were all cauliflowered. And he took me aside and said, look, this nightlife in Lauderdale, I know you're loving this right now as a young guy, because he heard I had an offer to maybe go up to Canadian Football League and get a tryout. He goes, I'm telling you, you can always come back to this. He goes, if I was you, he goes, I'd work hard, take that offer up there in Canada and go for it. Because Canada, like you said, John, did not have the age restriction. So I went up there. I was still 19 years old. And I was, I guess, the youngest American that ever made a team up there. And talk about timing, just like how I got in wrestling. The guy who was all pro up in Canada, who was an American, you know, there's so many Americans per team, did a contract holdout. The coach took a liking to me. I ended up sliding right into his spot, and they ended up trading him. So I mean, I walked right in and got a spot on the team. It was incredible.
Was that where you got to play in the Grey Cup? Because I'd read online, which
my rookie
if it's online, yeah. Must be true.
I played against Warren Moon in the Grey Cup. They beat us.
Really?
That was a thrill.
Wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Moon, if you could count all the records he had in Canada, he had more passing yards than any human being ever walked on the planet.
Crazy. Crazy.
What an accurate guy, too. That much of a...
Then from there, after the Grey Cup, did you not want to stay in Canada, or is that when the USFL started back up?
Well, I always had NFL aspirations, but I wasn't of age yet. My contract was up in Montreal. I signed with Green Bay Packers, and I spent a year down the injured reserve. And then the Bandit Ball down in Tampa with Coach Spurrier, the ball coach. And I ended up getting the opportunity to play there with the Bandits, ended up with the Memphis Showboats with Pepper Rogers. Talk about fun coaches in the USFL. Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Steve Spurrier and Pepper Rogers. Yeah, you had Steve Spurrier and Pepper Rogers. They're known as two of the most greatest coaches and fun coaches, player coaches to be around.
Oh, Pepper, when it was real hot out in Memphis in the early summer, he'd have to start opening practice and get us about a half hour in. We worked up a good sweat, and he'd call a team together and go, man, it's hot out here, ain't it, boys? We go, I'd be like, well, yeah, you know, hell yeah. And he'd go, well, guess what? We got beer and barbecue and cold beverages over there. Let's just take it in. The guys all look at each other like, are you kidding me? He would do stuff like that that no football coaches do that. So, but boy, you wanted to play for him on game day. Man, I'm telling you, he was a great coach. He was a lot of fun.
Not only did you have Steve Spurrier here in Tampa for the Tampa Bay Bandits, you guys own the city. I was telling John earlier that, you know, the impact that the Bandits had here, the Buccaneers, you know, whether the old Buccaneers, they sucked, you know, and I was one of those poor fans that sat through the 0-26, so I know how bad they sucked. And sat out there in that heat and everything. Then Tampa Bay Bandits come along. Not only was Steve Spurrier his coach, but they brought in Burt Reynolds as an owner. And, of course, Burt brought Lonnie Anderson in as one of the owners. And there were several other guys. You probably remember a good friend of mine, Jim McVay, Alex. He runs the Outback Bowl here now, and he's still a good friend of mine, and I see him all the time. But the Bandit Bowl, you guys were averaging 40,000 people, while the Buccaneers were averaging around 15,000. You guys basically
owned the city. We were outdrawing the NFL team. That was a blast. The stadium was electric. Spurrier was already wide open, which back then was unusual with the passing attack. They called it Bandit Bowl. We had so much fun. Great memories of that, for sure.
If the USFL hadn't gotten a lawsuit with the NFL and then end up winning, but really not winning, it folded the league, would you have stayed in the USFL?
You know, I might have. There was such a glut of guys trying to get back in the NFL. And I, of course, walked into Championship Wrestling in Florida and met Mihiro Matsuda. And the rest is history as far as my going to wrestling. But, yeah, I might have ended up never wrestling and staying in football, for sure. And so many great players came out of that league. People were going way back, but my gosh. Some NFL all-time greats came out of that USFL. That was quite a league.
You were Herschel Walker league right time too, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How was it playing? I'm sure you guys played with the New York Titans or whatever.
The Jersey Generals, Donald Trump.
Jersey Generals. Yeah, Donald Trump on the team. I'm sure you ran it head-to-head with Herschel then.
Oh, he was something else, man. Wow. Unstoppable.
Lex, I saw that when I was at the L.A. for a cup of coffee, I had to go against Howie Long every day. But fortunately,
oh my God,
Howie Long was not a practice player. He didn't look.
That's good. That's a good thing.
Which is a good thing for me, because Howie wanted to do is get one look and one step, and don't try to make the team off of him, and it's going to be an easy day. You had Reggie White at Memphis, and you said not the lazy practice player.
He was not. He would talk about a force of nature. We talked about Ron. Reggie White was, I mean, he was like, if you try to run block him, it was like running into talk about getting stoned, like running into a brick wall. Unbelievable. When we'd have, back then, the old days, we used to have that Oklahoma drill where you're both on your back. Oh. The running back's behind you, and you both line up across from each other. It's a run drill. Man, no one wanted to get in line against Reggie. Everybody like start shifting so they wouldn't get in line and go against Reggie. He was unbelievable.
The dumbest drill ever. And, of course, it's named after Jerry's home state.
Yeah, absolutely. There you go,
Jerry. Well, you had to be a man to do that drill, I'll tell you.
You had to be skinny or something. I hated that drill. He just lined up and just got concussions.
And just hit each other. I mean, that's what we're doing.
That's all you did. You
stand in a circle and stand in a circle and call numbers out, run into each other. What else is there to do out there, Dot?
Well, I saw a video recently on Twitter, I think it was, and they showed two kids doing the Oklahoma drill. And all these comments from our new woke culture was, who's allowing this to happen and all that stuff. I'm like, man, we should do that in preseason, like every day in practice.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
Water breaks. There was no water breaks. Yeah.
When you were
barbecue breaks, but no water breaks.
Yeah. They had beer breaks, but they didn't have water breaks.
Well, pepper was not the norm for coaches, even back then, for sure.
Lex, when you were with Green Bay, were you injured or just on injured reserve? Because that's how they kept the guys a lot.
I did get injured in preseason, and so it was a legit injury at the time. Yeah,
because they did that a lot to keep players.
Right.
So I didn't know if when you're on injured reserve, no one ever knew. You know, because that's how teams kept guys.
Yeah. I actually got injured 2 weeks out from the final cutdown. That they liked me enough that they definitely wanted to keep me on the team. So, but I actually had a legit injury for sure.
Yeah. I'd seen online that you had, you met Bob Roop at a celebrity golf tournament. Was that how you got connected to Hero?
I love Wikipedia, because so much on there is true, but they mix in total fables. But I never met Bob Roop at a golf tournament.
I got to jump in there. When I saw that, I said, I know Bob Roop never went to a golf tournament. I've known Bob Roop since 1964,
Hung out in the beer cart, but Bob wasn't playing any golf.
No.
You're telling me something on the internet's wrong?
Something on Wikipedia. Can you believe it? Wow. I don't know who put that in there for a rib or something. Because it's like all these truths, but people slide in like stuff that never happened. That's like, I think it's kind of a rib. But I read that. I go, what are they talking about? Bob Roop in a golf tournament? I go, my gosh, that's a total falsehood. I'm glad we brought that up. We cleared that up once and for all.
So how did you get the honor of meeting Mr. Matsuda?
I was in the off season of football. I walked into the Championship Wrestling Florida office, which you're familiar with, that old building down there. Down in Tampa, and bumped, and Danny Miller was like the bouncer at the front desk.
Right.
And I talked to him. He took a look at me. You know, I was loved working the weights and stuff. He looked at me, goes, I think he sent me to figure Hero Matsuda to run me off. But he sent me over to the factory. Matsuda trained guys in that sweat box.
He had over on Lois Avenue, right up from the body shop there.
He would turn the air conditioning off. It'd be 130 degrees in there and take you through Hindu squats and push-ups. You do it all with you now. But I figured Danny probably figured out a Hero run this football player off. But Hero and I hit it off, and I never went back to football. I know John was asking me, do I think I'd still be playing football? I was still going to have a football career. But Hero and I hit it off so incredible. He actually managed me on my first few matches, came to me at the shows, and we hit it off, a special friendship. I'll never forget. Talk about people who pour into other people's lives and mentor people. And Matsuda got my career started. And it was like the 4th of July fireworks. I'd imagine Wahoo McDaniels, one of the greatest ever, 3 weeks into my career for the Southern Heavyweight title.
Wow.
I mean, it was crazy. Wahoo asked him, what am I supposed to do with this guy? He doesn't know anything. And Matsuda did the old line, well, Wahoo, if you're so good, you can have match with broomstick. So
that sounds like Matsuda. Mm-hmm. And then Wahoo wasn't going to talk back. He talked back to a lot of people, but Wahoo wasn't going to talk back to Hiro Matsuda.
No, people took Hiro seriously. He had mellowed out a little bit by time. Yeah. He didn't break my leg like he did Hogan's and stuff, but thankfully. But Matsuda was a serious kind of guy now.
Yeah. John, the facility, like I said, it was over in Drew Park on Lois Avenue, and it's right there by Tampa Stadium and the baseball parks, but it's stuck off in the corner. The body shop is like two blocks from over there, and Matsuda ran it like it was a damn sweat factory there. He made international singlet for the international wrestling teams in Japan and the United States. Mm-hmm. And he had sewing machines in there, and he had women sewing in there, and he'd turn off all the air conditioning because he didn't like air conditioning, and the women did. They figured they'd work faster. But he'd also have the wrestler there. He had some weights in there, and the floor is covered with mats. And he had guys screaming all over that Drew Park area there. And what an experience that had to be.
He'd have us meet him there, like you think it'd be early morning when it's cooler down in Florida in the summer. He has to meet him there like 4 p.m. He'd take us out for a 5-mile run as a warm up.
Yeah, he had that run around the park there, that run around like 5 blocks. And my goal, Lex, when I went over there, I don't know what got into me, but one time I just, you know what, I want to see what all this is about. I'd heard all of this about Mad City training guys. So I when you start in your next camp, so I went over. And so the camp was, at that time, he was doing a three-week camp. So I said, I'm going to make it. And I ran that course at him, and he beat me like I was crawling. He was Usain Bolt. So my goal at that time was I'm going to stay in this camp until I can outrun Matsuda in this run. I don't care about the wrestling part of it. I don't care about the lifting. I just want to beat him in this 5-mile run. So about a week and a half in, I was feeling good, man. I've been training. I beat Matsuda. I put my gear on. He said, where are you going when I'm finished yet? I said, I'm finished. I never walked back in that damn place again.
Matsuda was very competitive. My gosh. Yeah. Yeah. We do like push-ups, like 50 reps each. Like, and as soon as he was done, you'd go. And on those little platforms. And man, we got each other. When the one guy was finished, we'd be pushing each other off. He'd be bound to push me off to do his set right away. He was competitive, man. I'm telling you, he was something else. What a great man.
You were actually in the ring within a few months of the time you started training, having title matches. I mean, you were, you know, I told John earlier, too, if a moniker ever stuck with a guy and fit a guy, that total package fits you, right? Even right from the very beginning, Lex, you had all the looks and all the talent necessary there. So they pushed you right to the top, and you were wrestling for titles, I mean, almost immediately out of the gate.
Yeah, I won the Southern Heavyweight title, I think, like 2 months in against Jesse Barr. And then Flair came down and wrestled me in an hour Broadway. And what was that life-changing? Ric Flair was Daytona Beach Oceanfront Center there in Daytona. And Rick showed up with the limo and the custom suits, the diamond rings and jewelry and the Rolex. And I was like, man, I want to be like him.
Yeah.
And Rick, I don't know how he got me through an hour Broadway. He called a sunset flip. I'd never done one. Didn't even know what it was. Rick called a sunset flip. You know, I go, what's that? Rick was, oh my God.
I love it.
Somehow Rick carried me like only Rick could do, right? Nate, through an hour Broadway, down in Daytona Beach. He went back and Rick talked me up to the Crockett's and NWA. And a few months later, I was in there with the Horsemen, if you can believe it.
And you weren't even in the business a year when you went that hour Broadway with Rick, right?
Oh, yeah. I was probably in 6 months.
Huh. Ow.
Yeah. And Rick went up and talked me up at the Crockett's, and at less than the 1 year mark, I was in there with the whole four horsemen replacing Ole. I mean, can you believe that? Wow. Amazing. Yeah.
Thankfully, Ole wanted to watch his kid wrestle. And wasn't that what it was that Ole did?
Oh, yeah, that was a shoot. But yeah, we squeezed him right out, man. He didn't help him in a closet. The rest was history.
How'd you like working with Crockett?
Oh, it was great. We had a great group down there. I was with Aaron Tully and Nate and JJ and Ren. We had just so much fun traveling together and hanging out together. Crockett had the private jet. Oh my gosh, it was an amazing transition coming from football into that environment. And I remember Dusty, who was the booker at the time, said, "Hey, Lex is a really straight guy. He's coming from football, happily married. Nate, don't leave him alone. Don't mess with him." Of course, that didn't last long. I jumped right in and got right with it. But because Rick, I always tell Rick, you ruined me, because Rick, everything I did, Rick was mentoring me. Like, he told me I had to buy a Rolex. So I went and bought a Rolex. I wasn't making Ric Flair money right away. And then he sent me, "You got to go buy a Mercedes." So I went and I bought like a top of the line Mercedes. And then I go to Rick. I go, "Rick, where do you tint your windows for the Mercedes around here in Charlotte? We live in Charlottetown." And Rick goes, "Don't you dare tint those windows." I go, "Well, why not? It's hot here in the summer." He goes, "If you're going to buy a top of the line Mercedes," Rick said, "you want everybody to see who's driving that car." He goes, "Don't you dare tint those windows. It's all about image enhancement, baby." So Nate, man, you ruined me with all that image enhancement stuff. I really modeled my early career. I wanted to be just like Nate. He got me one of those robes that the girl made for him. It cost $5,000, which was a lot of money for me at the time, with the rhinestones and with Lex Luger on it. I really patterned myself up. There's only one Nate, but he was like, man, I was really trying to be like another nature boy. That was a lot of fun.
When they had the U.S. title on you for so long, you know, it's really unusual in wrestling. You know, Steamboat and Savage, you know, really raised the Intercontinental Championship. And several guys have done it since. Brett and Davey had a fight over the Intercontinental Championship, you know, really raised. But it's hard to raise a title that's not the World Heavyweight Championship. You did it in WCW. Did you know at the time you're thinking, I'm really raising the status of this? Or was it just a matter of you're going from 1 week to the next as far as storylines and angles? Because you had so many great people to work with.
You know, I ended up in my career having world titles and world tag team titles and world television titles. But when I go to sign stuff, people think of me as like the U.S. champion. And really, Magnum and Nikita Koloff, Magnum TA, they kind of laid the groundwork with that U.S. title. And that title meant a lot back then. And I didn't really realize at the time how much history that U.S. title had, the NWA. And that kind of, to this day now, when I do signings, like I said, I was with Ron Simmons this weekend. We had a blast doing some, you know, mixing with fan interactive events and autographs and pictures. People, like when they pick out photos for me to sign, if they like that U.S. title, and we got like a U.S. title belt, a real replica, people love that. That's really my favorite title I ever had. Was the U.S. title that really got my career, like a foundation of my career going to, that meant so much to me. I love that. Plus, it's a really nice looking belt. So, yeah, I that U.S. title was definitely. I think I still am. I'm not bragging, but I think I still am the longest, like overall reign of 900-something days or something. Nowadays, with, you know, as we know, guys, pay-per-view and titles get switched so much now.
Yeah,
that's a long time to have a belt. I mean,
yeah, I think I had the U.S. title for about 30 days. So you're only like 918 days ahead of me.
Well, everything's on the 30-day clock now, right? It takes 2 months, right?
that's right. After that run, and then Flair decides to go to WWE, and he took the title with him. And that's when you and Wyndham had the great match. Did you have any trepidation about stepping in? And, you know, you mentioned how much you liked Flair. And, you know, it's just business. I understand it's nothing personal, but you're having to come in and make that replacement, which is one of the hardest things to do in a territory. You know, when a territory is hot, everybody wants to be on top. But when there's some type of transition, people aren't raising their hand very very quick to be on top. You had to be the guy.
Well, they kind of, I don't know if they kind of chose me to switch heel, and they put, I mean, they surrounded with greatness, Harley Race and a bodyguard. We tried to do all the bells and whistles. When I won the match at Cage, we didn't even have a title belt made yet. So don't hold the belt up. It's not a real, like a real title belt. And we, but they, I mean, they really tried out, but I mean, come on, anybody to step in the shoes of Ric Flair, who was known as the champion and WCW and NWA before that. There's no, I mean, I did the best I could, but that was a very difficult assignment for sure.
Yeah, you did a great job with it, but what a screw up it was to let Flair leave as champion with the title.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Do you have any idea how they let that happen, Lex? Were you privy to any of that information? What I mean, I can't imagine they just letting them leave like that.
Yeah, I think there was just a lot of stuff going on with Barnett and Rick and Dusty and Crockett. And I didn't know any of the details, to be honest with you. I was more of a foot soldier still at that point in my career. Right. But I knew there was a lot of stuff going on, but no one envisioned that Rick, because I guess that belt was actually a shoot, like NWA, and there was like a $10,000 deposit on her. I don't know what it was, but that was like crazy how they let him go to WWF at the time, WD with that belt. That was, like you said, a colossal error on their part.
Yeah, and here's the thing, it led a lot to the Montreal Screwjob with Bret Hart. I mean, Jerry, you might can address this more because you're the one giving Sean a quick tutorial on how to get out of the ring the night before. But you know, the main thought was we don't want Bret to show up on WCW television with that title like Flair did earlier, and that had a big impact, right, Jerry, on the mindset of WWE with the Montreal Screwjob.
Well, that was the exact mindset going into there. We didn't want the exact same thing to happen again. And Vince had tried, you know, I've listened to, I don't know how many, I've listened to people that wasn't even there, listened to people that wasn't even in the business at the time, you know, tell a story on exactly what happened there. But we'd been burnt with the Medusa, and we knew that what Flair had done, of course, and we didn't want the same thing happening, and it was over with, and it's rehashing the story, but Bret didn't want to do the time-honored tradition in the business. So my meeting with Sean that night, it was more of a meeting of helping Sean survive something, because you're not going to teach a guy to be mean overnight. And Shawn Michaels, as we all know, is not a big guy. He's a nice guy, and he's had the hell beat out of him several times. So he's not a fighter. So I went up and what do you know? And here's what you can do if you but you got to be the aggressor. You can't wait, So it was more me helping Shawn survive if anything seriously happened to him that night. So. Wow. But it was all based on, what had happened with Ric Flair and that title. We didn't want it to happen to us.
Lex, right after that, you had the title for quite a while, but in 91, you had reached your dates for your contract. I didn't realize your dates. When I heard you say in an interview, it was 275 dates a year.
I always ran out first 2 weeks in November. So they would usually assign me to an additional amount between early November and the end of the year. But Jim Herd was in charge at the time, the infamous Jim Herd. And he said, that money, we're paying him and we're supposed to pay him extra to work out the rest of the year, the hell with him. And so that kind of ticked me off. So here instead of congratulating me for surviving 275 matches and trying to fill in temporarily for Ric Flair, he didn't want to give me a bump, an extra pay for wrestling above my 275 dates. And I just picked up the phone and called Vince. And I'd met Vince in the past. And he said, well, maybe love to do business someday. I was a prototype type guy, looks-wise, for Vince, right? Yeah. And I called Vince. He said, well, because you got a year left of your contract, I can't mess with you on that because it was guaranteed contract with WCW. But we discussed the possibility of you not wrestling and telling you just want a year off and doing the bodybuilding thing. So we worked the bodybuilding gimmick for you, which I love because I love working out at the gym. I think, wow, a year off with pay wasn't like a big amount of money, but Vince was going to pay me to train for a year as a bodybuilder. Then I debut the following year, which I did with Bobby Heenan at Royal Rumble, but through the bodybuilding for a year. So I just went in the office of WCW, told Jim Herd that I wanted to take a year off, but I was burned out from so many dates because he jammed me up. He wasn't going to pay me any extra. Made a bunch of money on the way out. They wanted me to do a date in Japan. They paid me like 50 grand, which was huge money back then, to do a match in Japan. And I got a year off to weight train with Vince for the bodybuilding thing. I had a motorcycle wreck in the meantime, but still, it was a year off to stay home and train, work out, which I'd never been able to do. That was pretty sweet.
Do you still have a supply of IcoPro?
I get asked that all the time. I know I don't, but you got to admit, Vince is not afraid, right, to try new stuff. I mean, he went all in that bodybuild thing. It didn't work out. He went all in trying to get the next big, supplement line out there with the IcoPro. He's not afraid.
I had a jar, a can of that IcoPro in my pantry that must have sat there for 15 years. I don't know how many years, but about 3 or 4 years ago, my wife and I did some remodeling our house. We did our kitchen. And so, of course, she's going through there, all this supplements. She's looking at the date on there. If they throw this way, throw this way. I had two things in there in my pantry that I was saving. I had a 1973 bottle of Jim Beam that Paul Bosch gave me for Christmas. I was working with Harley on a show down there, and Paul Bosch had it, and he actually signed it to do it. Merry Christmas, Paul Bosch, 1973. I had that, and I had my container of IcoPro, and I just wanted to keep. I never took IcoPro, as you can tell. If I would, I'd been Lex Luger. Watch out, man. So,
yeah, there you go.
If I'd had a body, man, I'd been dangerous. But if I had any talent, I'd have been any more dangerous. But anyway, my wife disposed of my IcoPro, and I think she drank my bottle of Jim Beam. She said she tossed it, but I don't believe it. Two valued off-prize presents. If I had those down, I could put them on eBay. I bet you that can of IcoPro would draw me enough money where I wouldn't have to do this podcast with JBL.
Classic stuff.
You know what's cool, Lex, is Vince not only has the cojones to try stuff, he has the cojones to pull the plug, too.
He does,
so many
man.
So many guys, they try stuff, but then they have, their ego is so big, they stay with it. If Vince sees it's not working, he just pulls the plug, and day one, let's start over, do something different.
He does. He is a bold entrepreneur. You're right. He's got a great feel for it.
Absolutely. What happened with the WBF, the World Bodybuilding Federation? I mean, you got Gary Stridham, the champion. I think they signed Lou Ferrigno, but he never competed. But was it really that bodybuilding was tough to transition? Or was it just the fact that there's only one Arnold? Well, and you can't replicate Arnold.
What was, in my opinion, was the main reason that it didn't get over well, the WBF?
Right.
Well, number one, we all know Joe Reeder always had a stranglehold on bodybuilding. But if I had to use one word, wasting, this might be two words. My mom's a real wordsmith. I'd say the reason it didn't succeed back in that time was drug testing. And Vince was going through the trial, and the drug testing was totally legit. And back in that day, bodybuilding without drug testing didn't look the same. And the guys didn't look the same, and it bombed.
And when you had the Olympia that they weren't drug testing, you had these freaks, these guys that were unbelievable. It's just tough to compete with that.
Yeah. So the drug testing really, really killed that, to be honest with you, at that time.
Right.
Now, we're all glad there's drug testing now, and it's healthier for all the guys and the athletes. But at that time, all the bodybuilders were loaded up on stuff, and that really basically killed it. And just from my viewpoint.
Yeah. When you first heard about the Lex Express after that, what did you think?
Well, I really want to get Jerry's insight in this, because I have a funny story to share. They're doing this Icons, which I do a great job of wrestling. They're doing one on me, which was awesome. They've been working on that for 6 months. I guess we're going to be releasing it pretty soon. But when I went to the office, Vince, I was the narcissist. I mean, you know, looking in mirrors and all that. He called, you know, Val Vince is, he called me to his office, which I'm like, Vince wants me to like to come to his office. And like, we're on the road. And I'm like, okay, he's flying me in special's office. He laid it out that I was going to get on a bus all summer and slam Yokozuna and the Intrepid. I'm like, yeah. I'm thinking the whole time, yeah, but I'm the narcissist. How does that work, Vince? And I go, you think that'll work? Vince was, I promise you it'll work, which actually the Intrepid thing got over. That was a well-done event. But I was seeing a trailer for the Icons thing they have coming out soon on me, and they showed Brett and Jerry, you were in it as well. Like, you know, they asked everybody for insights, and I had the volume off. I'm trying to get the volume on my phone for the new trailer. And they show little excerpts of guys talking, and Brett goes, man, I'm thinking they're doing this nice thing on me and the Lex Express. And they have Brett talking about the Lex Express. And Bret Hart goes, well, I love Brett and I get along great. I laugh with Brett when I see him. He goes, man, that Lex Express was a curse for Lex. I'm like, well, that wasn't very nice. And then Jerry, you got to tell me with your Oklahoma twang. And that Jerry gets on and goes, that Lex Express was a total flop. Jerry, give me what you said on the Icons video. I love the way you said that.
I can't remember exactly what I said.
I got my information from Lex.
I got to tell you the truth. Where I got my information from, I got it from bad source. And I'm first to admit, when you get a bad source, you got a bad source. That damn Brother Love Bruce Prichard told me. that was my source.
Well, when I saw the Icons, like the little 1 minute thing, I think they're going to say all this nice stuff about me. I laughed so hard. About when Brett and you said, I go, well, I guess it's going to be kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly. Because I go, it's not just going to be a little, the Icons, boys, a shoot. It's kind of like, you know, they're gonna really go with this, you know. I was laughing so hard, Jerry.
What's up with that? Jerry, what's up with that?
I'm a stooge. What can I say?
Well, hey, but I blame the economy at the time, Jerry. The lines were big at all the autograph signings. SummerSlam, the buy rate wasn't up much. We had a really bad economy at the time. That's why it didn't work, get over too often. But, you know,
I blame Bruce Prichard for it, Lex. I mean, I don't blame you. You were the total package. You had everything. You had everything except Bruce Prichard was with you.
I think it was Bruce.
Well, yeah, but I thought I was going to do like the Lex Express, like Yankee Doodle Dandy, then go back to being like Lex with the total package. That's not what Vince had in mind.
That's not what he had in mind. No, he had that baby face all the way. I can't just imagine. You were traveling all day on this damn bus, and you know they were shooting guys in and out on you all the time. But you were the clog there that stayed there the whole time, and they were expecting you to be fresh every day. And I can understand. I mean, we all been on the road. We all had. And you were basically working 24/7 at that time.
Yeah, and not
a great environment.
That was exhilarating and exhausting at the same time. They'd get up at 4 a.m. Start the morning radio and TV shows. I would do 2 to 3 autograph signings for 2 to 3 hours at shopping malls. I do the nighttime weather guy stuff at the nighttime news. Then I'd get back to hotel like at 8, 9 o'clock at night. Then I, of course, I'm so driven. Then I'd go to the gym till like midnight, then sleep like 3 hours and start the whole thing over the next day. I mean, we did it all summer. It was unbelievable.
So how hard was it to work with Bruce Prichard?
You know, I didn't have a lot of contact with Bruce back then. He was more in the office back then.
Yeah.
So I didn't really interact with Bruce a lot back then.
Well,
I didn't know Bruce very well.
For full disclosure, Jerry and I are good friends with Bruce, and we're Bruce's only friends. We're the only one out of 8 million people that like Bruce. We're the only two people on the planet that like Bruce. So,
and we still haven't figured out why.
We don't know why. God. He won't even return our call now that he's a big shot.
I like Bruce. I mean, he
Bruce is, he's a funny guy.
Yeah, he is. He is. For sure. But, you know, that whole, it was a great experience. A lot of people felt that if you get that big of a buildup, you don't come through. It's kind of let the air out of the tires on the bus. You know, when you win by DQ, a lot of people said they wanted Taker. And Vince's real plan, I was never, people think I was promised the belt and everything. Vince never promised me the world title. And he told me flat out, if I put the belt on you, that's the direction we go. I'd like to see that at WrestleMania 10 next spring. So Vince got Yoko and Taker in an angle. We did the DQ. And Vince said, if we can rev this thing back up for WrestleMania, if that's the direction we go. But Vince never promised me the title, never said, you're going to be my guy. People all say that and think that, but that was never the case behind the scenes with that whole thing. A lot of people thought maybe he should have let me win in Detroit and SummerSlam, then he, and beat me even a week later on, you know, on Raw or something, you know, for the title. So I had the, as a babyface, kind of had the win after the big buildup. But other than that, Vince never made any promises of that thing, contrary to what a lot of people think. People ask me that all the time.
Yeah, WrestleMania 10, I guess it was, where you wrestled Brett with a tie in the Royal Rumble, right?
Well, we tied. I wrestled Yoko first. Kurt Hennig was a ref, and it was like kind of a screw job. And I was going to wrestle Kurt after that, but then Kurt didn't sign, you know, Kurt. And but I got it was like a another like a DQ win. So I got DQ'd or something. Oh yeah, Kurt DQ'd me. So Brett ended up wrestling Yoko. Brett was, you know, at that time I heard the rumors he was threatening maybe retirement. And Vince was looking for that baby face. And Brett was very reliable at the time. Great, obviously a great worker in the ring and was a great champion. And Vince went in that direction. So I never had thought I got slighted or didn't. Man, I was being featured in all these big pay-per-views. And I was in main event matches the whole time I was there. I loved the opportunity to go back to WCW at the time for the Monday Night Wars, but I look fondly back at my career with WWE, even though maybe people think it was not the big, that I was supposed to be the next Hulk Hogan. There was only going to be one Hulk Hogan. I never wanted to, or even thought there was going to be another Hulk Hogan. That's crazy. I wanted to be the best Lex Luger I could be. And so people kind of put that on me, but I enjoyed my time at WWE, but I was also loved getting back to WCW for the Monday Night Wars. That turned out to be a great move as well.
Lex, you just said a lesson there for a bunch of people, a bunch of young people that's in our business watching this podcast. Hopefully, that they picked up the same thing. You didn't want to be another Hulk Hogan. You wanted to be the best Lex Luger that you could be. When these guys now. I go, as you know, I'm out recruiting college. I want to be the next Brock Lesnar. I want to be this. I want to be the next Johnson. And no, you don't. You could never be the next. You want to be the best guy that you can possibly be. It's good to think that way. But you just gave a little supplemental message there to everybody. Just be the best that you can be. Don't worry about Hulk Hogan or The Rock or any of these other guys. Be yourself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lex, you were getting a good push in WWE, and you had a offer. You know, Sting, from what I hear from Eric Bischoff, wanted you to come back to WCW. The Monday Night Wars were starting up. I don't think anybody dreamed that they would turn into what they turned into. What was your thought process for leaving WWE and going back to WCW at that point? Because you had a pretty good gig at WWE.
Yeah, they were sort of pressing the restart button with me. I was with the Allied Powers with Davey Boy, which I love doing as a tag team. They were going to break Davey Boy up as a tag team, him and I, and put us back as singles. Because Vince prefers his top talent to be able to be tagged, but also carried as a single. So he was coming up with storylines for Davey and I to split and singles. But at the time, my character was kind of in a transition phase. And I just put in my, we signed those 2-year deals. I just didn't renew. And Vince knew it. Vince and I were talking about where my character was going to go. I worked for, which I know is hard to believe, for 6 months without a contract at WWE. I planned on re-signing and wanted to. I, in casual conversation with Sting, because we've always been best of friends, mentioned that I was somehow in our conversation that I was working at WWE without a contract. He goes, Sting, like, almost dropped his phone. Wait a second. You're wrestling in WWE the last 6 months and you're not under contract? I go, no. We're just working on a handshake. We're going to work out a new contract. I wanted to do some stuff on the side, like in fitness. And I wanted the language in there for the contract with Vince. We were kind of just working out the final details. Sting got on the phone with Eric. And Eric wasn't too big on me at the time. So maybe a lowball offer. I talked to Sting and said, we're doing this new Monday night show. I'm telling you, you come back and you and I can do some stuff together. And we're such good friends. I met in secret at Sting's house. And Eric and I talked. And 2 weeks later, I was on house shows in Canada for Vince and Moncton, New Brunswick, and all of them up there. And the next night, I walked out on Nitro in the Mall of America. Right off, I actually did take me out of the TV shows that I was in for, that I'd done with Vince the week before. I was on those shows. They had to pull me off those shows.
And wow. So you thought, by talking to Sting's enough, that you thought that the opportunity was so big that you were willing to take a lowball offer because you saw what the opportunity could be.
Well, Eric heard I could be not hard to work with, but I had a little bit of, I always said it was confidence, but a little bit of arrogance about me, which I did, I've been told. And Eric wasn't too sure if I'd fit in with kind of my reputation in the business. So he wanted to test me by lowballing. His thing goes, Eric's going to lowball you. Don't get insulted. I go, oh. And he goes, but you get in the door and you'll get a good deal. So, and it worked out incredible. They kept me. I mean, they hit me at a different hotel across town in Minneapolis. They brought me in the back door of the mall with a towel over my head and like a sheet around me, so you couldn't see my body. And on the other end of the mall, none of the boys knew until other than Eric and Sting. I think Hogan might have known, but when they walked me to the gorilla position, we all call it. Even though Gorilla wasn't there, we all call it the Gorilla. And nobody knew I was there. And I just walked out on the show at the end there. Who would have known? I mean, we didn't have any idea then that it was going to turn into like a big Monday Night War, but that was kind of a good to be at the opportunity to be one of the first shots fired on that competition war thing. I had no idea it was going to get that big. And boy, the rest was man, you talk about a historic time in the business to be able to be a part of that. Wow.
Yeah, there's never been anything like it where you have two competing opposite shows at the same exact time live. I mean, it's like two football leagues or two. I mean, the ratings were astronomical. We're both doing fours at the same time. Fours.
I mean, just insane. That whole Attitude Era, all that. Just the economy was good. People had that spendable thing. It was everything. All the stars aligned for that in the late 90s. Yeah. It was incredible.
And perhaps it was probably the greatest time in professional wrestling history. You guys both know I've been around since the mid 50s in wrestling and 1960.
Gerald, was that 18?
Well, yeah, I'm not Bruce Prichard. I was with George Hackensmith and Mr. Gotch there, But yeah, I've been around since the 60s and I've seen, you know, the big houses. And of course, I was right in front of right behind when O'Connor and all the guys were drawing those Comiskey Parks and those Wrigley Field and those big arena shows like that. But two organizations that were going there, I mean, it was great to be a part of. And we all three of us got to take great pride in probably being a part of perhaps the greatest time in our business history.
Yeah, people ask me the highlights of my career, obviously being a horseman, my slam Yokozuna, but man, that whole Monday night, being a part of that, a cog in the wheel, man, that was one of the real highlights of my career, for sure. I've wrestled 15 years. That was definitely one of the top three, for sure.
Lex, you know, you mentioned Yokozuna there. They're intrepid. That had to be a thrill for you. I remember when that concept was you know, it was brought up, and I was old school. I'd Tampa, Florida, old school, Oklahoma, and all of a sudden, oh, we're going to do this on the Intrepid. Well, okay, Intrepid battleship, you know, a carrier. Or how are we going to do this thing? And Vince's vision of it was exactly how it took place. And but you know, you were the wheel behind that thing there. That had to be a thrill for you. And this the whole setup of it, and you're going out, walking out there. I remember the pop when we walked out there. It was unbelievable.
Well, I was a heel at the time. I came down, pushed my manager Bobby Heenan out of the way, and got in the ring with a red, white, and blue outfit and cowboy boots, which were very slippery on the bottoms, by the way. They wanted me to wear cowboy boots. I tell people, I was so scared when I got in that ring, the Manhattan skyline, the USS Jeff. Yeah. I go, I'm going to try to pick Yokozuna up in these slippery cowboy boots. I'm going to be like a squash, like a bug. I'm going to fall on my backside. And he's going to squash me, trying to slam him. So I got nose to nose with Yoko in the ring. I go, Yoko, I can't do it. I got no traction. No, Yoko. He was a cool island boy. He goes, no problem, brother. Just get a wide base. Yoko, you know how agile he was. We called him the dancing bear. He literally, I can't take what people talk about. You slammed him. He almost slammed himself that day. So I had no footing. And people go, and some of the fans like that were watching their kids. You mean you knew you were going to slam him ahead of time? I go, man, I hate to spoil it for you, but yeah, it was pre-planned. They're like, oh, but you acted so excited. I go, no, I was so relieved that I was able to, that Yoko almost slammed himself with those cowboy boots on. Funny how you fixated something. I was begging you, Yoko, I can't do it. I can't do it. Yoko was great. What a great guy to work with, too. One of the best big men ever, I think. When Yoko came out in the building, Jerry, you were then, I mean, yeah. The crowd, we called him the showstopper. I mean, when he came down that aisle, that music, he was something else.
Yeah, there's moments you never forget, and there's moments that just live with you forever, and that's truly a moment that I'll never forget in my long career.
Yeah, it was great, a wonderful moment. I was that only something like you said, a guy, a visionary like Vince would dream up. But man, that was live, one take. We weren't gonna be able to redo it.
Yeah, so one take.
And we practiced the week before. Over in Stanford, and they didn't let me slam Yoko. So they didn't want me to get hurt. I'm looking at Yoko. We weighed Yoko on a trucking scale in Germany not long before that, 627 pounds.
Wow.
So I'm thinking, wait a second. You don't want me to slam him in practice to see if we can really do it? Because they didn't want Yoko to get hurt. I mean, what about me? My gosh. Yeah, I'm going to have like a double hernia here. What do you
mean? People don't realize, you know, I used to wear cowboy boots all the time and different stuff, you know, around the ring. It's so slippery. And
if you get the wrong surface, yeah, on the mat cover, man, you're like on ice skates or roller skates.
Yeah, when you got one take, you know, I used to take a key and I would scratch the bottom of my cowboy boots just to give me some traction.
I wasn't smart enough to do that. I'm not from Texas. I'm a New York boy.
Thank goodness.
What do you mean, thank goodness, Jerry? But, you know, people don't realize, you know, Hollywood will go spend, you know, a month getting ready for a stunt.
I can't believe I'm sitting here with Lex, with somebody that helped kill, supporter of a team that helped kill college football, the University of Texas Longhorns, John Lathan support.
We bolted for big money and took Oklahoma University with us and left Oklahoma State to go to the WAC or whatever. Jerry's very bad about this, Lex, in case you hadn't noticed.
Oh, yeah, Oklahoma, Texas. I get it. Runs deep.
You still
Lex, I mean, this is a story that you probably had to tell a thousand times, and John and I have been discussing it. Just, you know, it's almost something, you don't want to bring up, but, you know, I'm so interested in it, and I got to hear your version of it, the Brody story and a cage match.
Oh, yeah, that's one.
You had never seen a cage match, or even didn't know what a cage match was at that point in your career, and I'm sure you weren't very well coached on what to do in a cage match, so Just tell us something. That's a nice way,
but totally clueless. Yeah, I'm at. It was a long day. We did a TV in Tampa. We did our TVs. I drove across the Lauderdale, and they put up a cage. I'm like, cage match. What do I do? And Lauderdale, you couldn't talk before the match. They had the cage
on both sides.
Stage.
Yeah, that.
You couldn't talk. So here I am, close, and I heard all this stuff about Bruiser Brody. You know, like he's, you know, and I didn't know Frank. I only saw Bruiser Brody in there, and it was something about the long day and the trip from Tampa, and then we drive across to Lauderdale. I got in the cage. I didn't have a blade on me. I had no idea what I was doing, and I was trying to run him into the cage the first minute of the match. I had no clue what I was doing, and he just was like, stopped working, like, this ain't going to work. And I didn't know what he was doing, and I tried to, like,
in other words, you wasn't in the ring with no Ric Flair that could take you 60 minutes.
No, he just, about 2 minutes in the match or 3 minutes, just stopped working. I'd punch him. He wouldn't sell it. He'd do that little thing he did, that little sound, shake his head. And he was a big, scary guy, looking guy. And so Fonzie was the referee, thankfully. And I go, Fonzie, what's going on? I'd only been working a number of months. I go, what do we do? What's wrong with him? Fonzie's like, I don't know, brother. He goes, I don't know what he's doing. So I go, what do we do? Fonzie told me, back him into the corner, start punching him. I'll grab your arm, sling me back when I grab your arm when you're punching him, and I'll DQ you. Because we didn't know what to do. He just stopped working. And then here he is with his fingers all taped up with razor blades. And then, of course, the ring guy couldn't get the door unlocked. At this point, I was like a scared jackrabbit. I leapt up on the cage and jumped. I didn't know what he was going to do, Brody. I mean, I didn't know whether he was going to cut me with the razor blades. I was legitimately scared of what was going on. I thought he was like having a mental incident, or maybe he was on something. I was legitimately. I mean, I got a wife and a new baby at home. I'm getting out of this cage.
And I think you're right, probably on both of those.
I walked over after the match because I said, man, Matsuda, if I don't walk over there and ask what I did wrong and apologize for whatever I did. I walked over there and Engelbert Humperdinck was in the room with them. I kind of knocked on the door. I go, well, if I'm going to get my butt whooped, I'm going to walk over there, at least go over there and find out what happened, because Matsuda, you know, taught me that way. I walked over, knocked the door, and Humperdinck said, I'm sorry, sir, but I don't know what happened there. I'd never been in a cage before. And now I'm talking to Frank, not Bruiser Brody. He goes, don't worry about it, brother. I'm in Texas right now. They're switching me, baby. He goes, you're going to, at the time I'd already been on TV, like that I was going to be going to, like, maybe be a horseman. You're going heel up in Atlanta. He goes, we're in a cage. You've never done it before. He goes, it's been a long day. He goes, don't worry about it. He was real nice.
Wow.
He just wasn't working.
There was never any post heat.
And boy, was I relieved, too.
There was never any heat with you guys afterward or anything like that, right?
Now, zero, but they wanted me to be in a cage on the following week in Lakeland, and I bowed out.
Well, I don't blame you.
What guy did about that was you had worked with Brody before, right?
Right. In a regular match.
And then when you get in the ring, I'd heard all this stuff about Brody and Lex. You know, this is several years ago that it was a shoot and all this stuff. It wasn't a shoot. Brody just quit working. I'd never seen anything like it. He just stood there.
You know, we had worked regular matches down in Florida, you know, do the loop, and we were fine. I mean, he worked snug, and I came from football. John, you know, I liked working snug. We had no problem. He just stopped working that match. And then, of course, the following week, I'm getting ready to go to Atlanta with the horseman thing. And I told Matsuda, who I love, that he said, you do the one more cage match in Lakeland. I go, Hero. I go, I don't know what's going on with him, going on with Bruiser, but I go, I'll come to the show. It worked out a thing where I got beat up and jumped on the way to the ring and another guy wrestling the cage. But I go, I don't really, I'm not comfortable getting in a cage with him, to be honest with you.
After 20 something years of retrospect, have you figured out any reason for him to just quit working? Because it wasn't like he quit working and went after you. He just quit working. He just stood there.
Yeah. I thought
I've never seen anything like that.
No, I to this day, I wish I could. I wish he was still here. I mean, he's not with us anymore. I'd love to find out what he was thinking, because I never knew. I never found out.
But you're right about one thing. Those were such brutal days when we do TV on Wednesday morning, John. We'd have Tuesday night Tampa. And of course, Tuesday night you're in Tampa, you'd want to go out and have a beer or be a little sociable. So sometimes at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning before you get in bed, and then you're up at 7 o'clock and you're TV at 8:30 in the morning here in Florida, and it's brutally hot in that old sportatorium that we had down there. You right. do a couple hours of TV taping, you all burn out already. You know, the beer's out of you, sweated the beer out of you. Now you got to get in a damn car and drive across the state of Florida for about 6 hours.
Yeah, through damn, the Everglades, across the Miami.
And drive through the Everglades and Alligator yep. Alley and all that crap. And then fight the traffic once you get near Miami and Lauderdale. Then you got to go and get ready to do it all over again, man. Those were brutal days. And tempers weren't always calm when you got to the building down there, because everybody was right. busy. Because Wednesday was also payday for the loop right. too. So
it had been a long.
So Brody probably got stiffed on his payoff and took it out on you.
You know, John, my only guess would be that's a good question. What was he thinking? I think he was just like partly what he told me. This why would they book me with this kid who's never been in a cage before? He's clueless how to have a cage match. And that I'm Bruiser Brody, who's had hundreds of cage matches. Why would they put this together on a long day? We just did TV. I think he was just basically like disgusted. Like he just stopped working.
Right.
You know, I mean, that would be my guess. Like, what am I doing in a cage with this guy? This is ridiculous. He's just kind of like, I'm done for the day.
You talked to him afterwards and there wasn't heat with you.
No, none. Zero.
What a crazy, yeah, he was totally crazy cool. event.
Yeah.
Did you have during that time after you went back and you were kind of the first shot fired in the Monday Night Wars? I didn't know who was going to win. I was with WWE with Jerry and
right. You know, right.
We didn't know. People can say that they knew. Maybe they did. Maybe they had inclination. I did not. I thought Vince McMahon would hopefully figure out a way. During that time, who did you think would win?
Vince. I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. I've told many people this. I went to this big event for the opening of the old Braves Stadium at the time. It was opening like 97, and the Braves were going to play over. They did me as kind of a talking, like they had all the big executives come in for TBS, TNT, all the big advertisers. And they had this ice sculptures and shrimp and lobster. They had it overlooking the Braves Stadium. Hadn't opened yet, but it was almost ready to open. It was quite the setting. I mean, I was in there with all these suit and tie guys. I was kind of just like a something for them to look at, you know? And they laid out the kind of the vision for TBS and TNT, because AOL Time Warner had come in on the business merger there. And we were kind of like their black sheep, that pro wrestling, but we got really good ratings. And the top guys and the top of CNN Tower with the big windows and the big plant, big desks, were all there laying it out. They talked about where they were going with TNT and where they wanted to go with TBS. And they're talking to the big advertisers, Coca-Cola and all them. They laid out all Hill Street Blues and all these programs they're going to put on and what they're going to do with the vision of the networks. They didn't mention one word about wrestling. I went home to my wife that night. I go, Peg? She goes, yeah. I go, I don't think Turner, you know, Ted was always the guy, but now it's AOL Time Warner. I go, I don't think they have any desire. I go, if our ratings ever drop, I go, we're gone. They have no desire to carry wrestling on their program. That is not in their plan. I go, that I was a conversation piece of that event. And I go, they are not going to keep wrestling. So I knew when push came to shove, and it really went ahead, that just my personal feeling, that 97 event I was at, I was privy to, they showed their hand, AOL Time Warner, they had no interest in keeping wrestling. They ended up basically giving it away, right? Instead of fighting back and Continue War. They like just sold all their content like a fire sale and gave it to Vince when Vince surged ahead.
Right.
So really that glimpse I got back in 97, the guys in the towers, way above the, just the WCW brand that they had there. I was convinced they were looking for a way to dump it. First chance they got.
Yeah. It was that, huge AOL merger that, you know, ended up being horribly overpaid merger. And that pretty much killed the WCW at the same time.
Well, Ted used to always come see us at some of the television tape and said, you guys are my wrestlers, he'd call us. And he goes, as long as I'm here, you're here. But at that point, he finally did not have the final say so. He was not a majority shareholder anymore. He was still involved, but his role was actually, he founded it all, but he was more minor at that point. John, you know, you're a business guy. I watch you on Fox Business stuff all the time. You know how that works, right? Once he was a majority shareholder anymore, he had no say so over the wrestling, and they were looking to get rid of it. And I'm convinced from back in 97, they were looking for the first, because our ratings were so high they couldn't get rid of us. We were kind of low cost production and high ratings. But once it dipped, they were looking to unload it for sure. So that's why I think I was convinced Vince was going to end up winning, because Vince, it's his life, it's his passion. He's going to stay with it. And with the wrestling. And we did not have that commitment from AOL Time Warner.
Yeah. One thing that I didn't realize until I saw some of your interviews was what good friends you were with Harley Race. You're talking about people, you know, being like, Harley Race was let go at one point and you went to bat for him, which I thought was pretty cool. But I didn't realize that you had Harley, you had Bobby Heenan, he had some of the greatest managers of all time. I didn't realize you were such good friends with Harley Race and actually rode with him for a while.
I did. And you know, I think they figured I needed a lot of help. I had the body, but I needed a lot of help in the ring. So I was never known for my work. And I had a good look, but I wasn't known for my working ability in the ring. And so they always like put Harley or somebody with me. And yeah, Harley Race, everybody knows the story, but it was, I heard, but until I experienced it, I always liked the drive, right? But when you got in a car with Harley, Harley was driving. And he did. He had the cigarette in one hand. He had a beer in the other, and he had that cigarette hand on the steering wheel. And Harley, we always got that that Avis Cadillac, and Harley would bury that speedometer like 110, wherever would go to. Harley and like, I mean, unbelievable. He was a road warrior, and Harley was the real deal, and he was what an honor. And a pleasure to be around him and learn from him. And he was a special guy.
Probably the most legendary wheel man in the history of the business.
I thought I was a pretty good wheel man, but Harley was the man. He was the all-time wheel man. No doubt about it.
Hey, Gerald, I think you're on mute.
Well, I guess it's just you and me now, John.
It's just us. We lost Jerry, which is the best part of the show. He's from Oklahoma. You know, I had to send him all kinds of like the tomato can and the string between
exactly.
Oklahoma. Yep. Yeah.
I don't have to put up with this crap, you know. You He's think I bad. Can't hear you, Layfield, but I can hear everyone.
You know, hey, Lex, I'll tell you.
That's how these Texans are. Yeah, you've been friends with a Texan. You always got to keep your eyes on them. I mean, if you go off 1 second, you know, that dumb Okie, you know, from south north of the Red River. Yeah.
Hey, you got to be careful. I spent this past weekend in Texas, and Texas people are very friendly. I like Oklahoma folks too, but man, they are the friendliest people. I'm telling you, Ron and I were in there.
That sounds like a country and western song.
Yeah, I'm telling you, nice people down there.
Lex, I got the opportunity, it was an honor to interview Sting one time for the WWE Network, and he kind of like you did went through some rough times, which a lot of people didn't know about. You know, and then
that's a nice way of putting it, John. Some real bad choices with drugs, alcohol, women. Yeah, definitely had a cascading downward spiral for me. You know, I would never would have admitted. I always thought I had control of it and had a handle on it. And I can stop anytime I want. I used to stop sometimes to show everybody I could do it until I couldn't. And my life completely came apart right after my contract was extended for like a guarantee for 2 more years when Vince bought us out. I had way too much money and way too much time on my hands. And I was making a lot of bad decisions in my life. We all know the tragic passing of Elizabeth, who was my girlfriend at the time. And people thought that might be my wake-up call. It wasn't. I'm a miracle to be sitting in front of you guys. I know I'm taking a serious turn here, to still be alive and talking to you guys. If it wasn't for people that God put in my life, and I try to give back to that now, John. Sting's the same way. I was in jail on drug charges, and I met this chaplain guy kept on trying to talk to me. I was basically like an agnostic atheist guy. I didn't grow up in church, and he took me to a church service when I got out. He tracked me down and wanted me to work him out. I thought I'd run him out of the gym. I couldn't get rid of this chaplain guy. I thought I'd like make him so sore doing lunges and squats. And we ended up hanging together. He invited me to a Sunday night church service one. Dr. Frady ended up becoming my earthly spiritual dad. Did a message on, are you standing on the rock or the sand? And I realized that, man, our careers change, our finances change, people change in our lives. And there's really, my whole life has been based on shifting sand. That was the message. Or are you going to base your life on the eternal rock, meaning Jesus? And a week later in a hotel room, I committed my life to Christ, and my whole life transformed. I realized there's a much bigger purpose in life than just ourselves. We're here to serve others. It used to be myself and I. And I realized now it was Jesus, others, and then you, the joy formula, J-O-Y. And it just gave me a whole new, bigger purpose of why I'm here in my life. And Sting had gone through it in 98. And I thought I'd lost my best friend. Him and I had our only real friendship separation, because I thought, man, Jesus has become like a Jesus freak. I was mad at him because he didn't want to go drinking with me anymore and womanizing and partying. And from 98 to 06, there was a real fracture in our friendship. And then I got saved, and God reunited us. And I tell people, God takes our worst decisions we make in terms of the positive. Now, we talked about earlier about mentoring people, and now I do recovery coaching, and to help people that are going through the same struggles I had, let them know there's light on the other side. And I love doing that. And I just know God will take our worst things and comfort us and bring us through it. And now he wants us to do that with others. So I know, John, we talked earlier, you do a lot of stuff with young boys, the rugby. And Jerry, you've mentored so many guys at WWE for decades. And that's what it's really about, is mentoring. And I have accountability people in my life now that I never had. I could go on and on. But that April 23rd of 06 was my transformational moment for eternity. And I'm so thankful. And God brought me through a spinal cord injury where I had a 1% chance of ever standing or walking again. I can stand again and walk. I'm not the same guy. I lost 100 pounds of muscle from my neurological injury up in my cervical area. But I'm so thankful what I can do. And, you know, I also, God surrounded me so many strong people in my life. Let me know, don't focus on what you can't do, Lex. Focus on what you can do. So I'm so thankful for it. I know I said a lot there, John, but I love each day. I know it's a gift now, and I just wake up with that attitude of gratitude. And I haven't touched a drug or a sip of alcohol in over a decade. And I'm so thankful for the people God's placed in my life and what he's done in my life. I tell people it's experiential. I can't describe. A lot of people, you can't describe it. It's only something you can experience. So,
You said a lot, but that's the most important thing you can say also. And it's an incredible story and an incredible inspiration. When Sting got the honor of interviewing Sting, he told me something, he really said it in a unique way. He said, I didn't go through a 10-step program. I went through a 1-step program. And there's so many guys who've gone through, you know, rehab and eventually sometimes they make it, but usually they don't make it the first time. But your whole reason for getting it was a religious reason, because of taking Jesus into your life, not because of rehab. Did you try rehab also during that time?
I went through a lot of rehabs. You learn a lot of good stuff there. They're effective for the short term. But I kept on going back to my old lifestyle until I had the conviction of God living inside me, really, and not wanting to put that in my body anymore, and knowing that that's the holy temple of the Holy Spirit. I didn't want to pollute that my body's a gift, you know, mental, physical, spiritual. That gave me the conviction and the desire to walk away. I was always on that roller coaster of drugs and alcohol. And really, for me personally, not, and a lot of people do the AA and all that stuff, and it's good stuff. And it's worked for a lot of people. I get it. But for me, it was like Sting was the 1-step program for sure. Absolutely.
And have you now worked with a lot of former of the boys, the girls, the guys who are in the business? Have a lot of them reached out to you as they've done to, you know, a lot of, you know, we came through an era of drugs, you know, the
70s, 80s. And the work hard, play hard era, right, John?
Right.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you really know how bad they were. You know, I don't think anybody knew really in the 80s how bad steroids could be for you, how bad pain pills could be for you. You know that now, right. But in hindsight, we didn't.
Now they just get addicted to the gaming and stuff, right? It's great. Most of the guys.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
A lot healthier for their bodies, for sure.
But part of what you're doing also is also with some of the old guys and girls in the wrestling business, right? They reach out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here to encourage them any way I can. You got to want help. I mean, you got to want to get help. And any of the guys, they know I'm always there, available to reach out. I'm one of many guys, but I've definitely tried to encourage guys and help them any way I can. So yeah, I enjoy doing that for sure. And I work with a group called Team Challenge. They work with people that have addiction issues, and I come and speak with their groups of men. It's a 1.5-year program that put guys on. So I really enjoy doing that.
How is your health now? After this, I heard it was a spinal stroke. Then I saw that you said it really wasn't. It was some type of spinal cord injury on a flight.
Right.
But how is your health now?
Man, I mean, I don't look the same, but really, looks can be deceived. I tell people, I'm the healthiest I have ever been. Talk about a miracle of God. My checkups, my doctors, other than your mobility issues you have, neurologically for your injury, go, my health and my blood work and my checkups and my blood pressure, everything. They tell me, you're one of the healthiest, I just turned 63 guys I've ever had in my office. I'm on no medications, zippo. I mean, I am ridiculously healthy. Now people look at me and go, man, look at Lax. Wow, he's so skinny and you know all that. I said, I've been streamlined and redefined. But health wise, I mean, I'm the healthiest I've ever been in my adult life, to be honest, which is I'm so thankful for that. And that's really a miracle as well.
Do you have
Lex, you have such a positive attitude after all your health issues that you went through and all the tragedies, starting with Miss Elizabeth and all that to you, but you fall back like a true athlete. It's got to give you some satisfaction, though, when you can look at yourself in the mirror when you get up in the morning. I feel good about myself, and I follow you on social media. You're one of the most positive guys out there, and that helps so much. I mean, when they see a guy like you with all the heartbreak that you go through, be so positive out there. It sends a message to these young people, men and women out there, that, hey, no matter how bad it is, if you have a great attitude towards life, you come back with it.
I mean, I know you guys can vouch for this. Well, really, in life, it's not what happens to you. It's how you respond to it. Adversity, right? I mean, my one mentor always told me, Lex, it's not the wind. Direction of the wind, it's the set of the sail. That's the only thing you can control in life. The wind can blow in any direction, but you could, if you can control the set of the sail and how you respond to both the good times or the adversity, is really the key. So for me, that's been, I tell people, young people, if there's one characteristic, because you can have good times and bad times, like, but that perseverance, man, just keep on persevering. Don't, the old Winston Churchill quote, right? Don't never, never, never quit. Just keep on keeping on, man. I tell people that's, if I could put my finger on a characteristic that I see in people in life that get through tough times and even is that spirit of perseverance. And a lot of times we could do that from guys like you and us, where we encourage people when they're going through tough times. Other people have been there for me, now I want to be there for others. But man, just perseverance, man. That's what, if there's a one quality I admire in people, is perseverance, for sure.
And the ability to know that an incident in your past doesn't define you.
You know, absolutely.
Your definition is written every day.
Yep. Each day we get a clean slate. So don't hang on to the old, you know, stuff. Are you going to use the stuff in the past that my mentors teach me as a bridge or a burden? Are you going to become bitter or better? And I choose to be better and use it as a bridge. And use my, like we talked about earlier, some of the worst times I went through, now I can help other people with that. Now that I've been brought to, you know, cross that bridge and come out the other side a better person. So, which I'm very thankful for.
Well, Lex, I'm with Jerry. I was watching all your interviews getting ready for this, and you're one of the most positive people I know. I don't know you that well. I've only met you, but it's really inspirational to see that and to see your message of what you're doing now, of positivity, your life dedicated to Jesus, to helping others. It's really a cool story. And when Jerry said we had a chance to get you on, I said, this is awesome, because I was also a big fan of Lex Luger, the total package, the four horse, the world champion. It's a real honor to have you on the show. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Thank you, John. I get up every morning, man. Thank God for the breath in my lungs and the beat of my heart, man. I love it. So I'm just going to keep on trying to put a good positive vibe out there for others, for sure.
Lex, I really appreciate you coming on, and I hope you forgive me for my comments I made on there.
But, you know, I love it.
I'm so glad you came. I was shooting. But Lex, thanks so much, man. You have had such a marvelous career, and wow, I mean, the experiences, and you know, people, I been in the business for so long, I'm shocked too, because people just don't realize you were just taken out of training school and put in a main event spot just about, and expected to compete with all these world-class athletes on a world-class level that you hadn't even had time to be on a local level at that time.
Yeah.
And you know, that mental toughness that you have, you develop as an athlete, and now as a person, as a man, brought you through all that, just like it did all your hardships there, and your belief and your faith and everything. And I've gained so much respect for you just in the last few months, to tell you the truth, and watching you on social media and how you've developed your brand, as the kids call it nowadays. And you're a positive man. And I'm proud to have you on there. Proud to say I know you and can become a friend of yours.
Thank you, Jerry. And John, thanks for so much for having me on, guys. A lot of fun. A lot of fun.